Hi, this is Bernie Wides, back on the air again, the Heritage Radio Network, and the show is The Naturalist. I've been away for about 5 weeks, and Jack has been playing some of my repeat shows, and one show that I had recorded at the New York State Marine Educators Association, for you folks that listen in regularly. Today, we're back live on the air, and my favorite partner guest is here, Carol Butler.
Glad to be back.
And we're going to do a show this morning on a part of my trip. I went down to the National Marine Educators Association Conference in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And Gatlinburg, Tennessee is a very strange place. Well, it's I'll just leave it at that. It's a cross between going to Disneyland and Coney Island.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of honky-tonky stuff there, but people really enjoy it because it was really mobbed. And Gatlinburg is in the heart of the Smoky Mountains. And the Smoky Mountains are really beautiful. And it's really sort of a shock. When you're driving into Gatlinburg, you go through a section of the Smokies, which is beautifully perfect, manicured road, and not a sign of litter or trash. And then all of a sudden you turn a bend and there's Gatlinburg. Mm-hmm. It's like stepping into another planet. Okay, before I really get into the show, our sponsor this morning is Acme Smoked Fish, located in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Acme has been a mainstay in New York's culinary landscape for over 55 years. Using old-world recipes, Acme produces the finest smoked salmon, whitefish, sable that discerning palates demand. For information on where to find Acme, Blue Hill, or Ruby Bay products, visit www.acmesmokedfish.com. And I can testify personally that their smoked fish is really good. That's one thing I didn't have on my trip. We didn't really have any Acme smoked fish.
No.
Down in Tennessee. I don't know if they reached that far, but we didn't have
any. Makes you glad to be back in New York.
And that's true, right? Even in spite of the weather. So, so the National Conference was a very good conference. And you may ask, why do the Marine educators have a conference in the middle of the country, practically?
And, well,
about 1,000 miles from the sea.
Right. That is a good question.
Well, the answer is that the organization moves the conference every year around the country. So it was determined to be in the southern part of the country. And the theme of the conference was From the Mountains to the Sea.
And you said Gatlinburg has a beautiful conference center. So that was part of the attraction, I guess.
Right. They have a really beautiful conference center, which was air-conditioned and really lovely, very nicely designed. So the theme of it was From the Mountains to the Sea, because as we all know, every time it rains on the land, eventually that water will end up in the sea. It may take a few years, but it eventually ends up in the sea. So the conference dealt with freshwater ecology, called limnology, as opposed to oceanography. This was limnology. And we spent one day in the park on a field trip all day, and we did water sampling of some of the streams in the park. And it's still sort of a pristine environment. There's no real industry that close to the park. They are suffering from smog from some of the big cities and stuff drifting over the park. But the park was beautiful, and just a word about the park itself. It's a national park.
What is the name of it now?
Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And it's not bigger than Yellowstone or Yosemite, but it's a good-sized park, and it has an interesting history. That land was being logged over, like most of our forests were, and the Rockefeller family bought a huge piece of that property, probably almost all the land that became the park, because he saw what was happening and he wanted to really save it for everybody to use. And with the stipulation that they wouldn't charge any admission. So you know, if you go visit a national park these days, there's an admission into the park. Helps support the park and pay for it and all that. But this is one of the few parks in the country where there's no admission, because that was what Rockefeller made them promise, that if he gave them the land, it would be for all the people and they wouldn't charge any admission.
Very nice.
So I would recommend visiting that park in the summer and the fall and the spring, because they have a very long spring. You know, they're much further south than we are. Tennessee is probably opposite North Carolina or maybe South Carolina along the coast, and it's a much milder climate. And the park is full of rhododendrons and mountain laurel. And you know, rhododendrons are these beautiful flowers a lot of people have in their gardens. And mountain laurels are a smaller edition of rhododendrons. Mm. They have evergreen leaves also, just like the rhodies, and they have an exquisite flower. And we have some out here on Long Island. When I used to live there, there was a whole section that had mountain laurels, but this park was full of it. So it's a good place to visit, and you can even go to Gatlinburg. If you have kids, it's a great place for kids because they have all this amusement stuff. And Dolly Parton's very famous down there.
Ah.
Everybody knows Dolly Parton. She's a genius in business, and we even went to one of her shows called the Great Stampede or something like that. And Carol, did you ever go to a rodeo when you were a kid?
I never
in the
have.
City?
I never have.
Okay, well, you know, the rodeos are roping and fancy horseback riding and all that stuff. Well, this show was something like that. You know, another interesting, a cultural thing I would call this is they did a recreation of the Civil War.
Oh.
Well, you know, you're in the South, and it's still a big part of the culture. So we sat in this big stadium, it was like Madison Square Garden, but a little smaller. And we had dinner while we watched the show, and they divided the stadium in half, and half the stadium was the North, and half the stadium was the South. And the wait persons who waited on us were wearing costumes of soldiers from the South and soldiers from the North. And you had to cheer all the time for yours.
Right.
So we happened to be in the section of the South where we were sitting. So we had this split loyalty. But it was a lot of fun, and it was a lot of beautiful horsemanship, a lot of horseback riding and stuff like that. So that was very interesting. So if you go to that area with kids, there's a lot for them to do. So let's get back to some natural history now. And I told you why they had the conference there, because, you know, when it rains, everything ends up in the ocean. So another thing about the park is they have the highest biodiversity for salamanders in North America. So when we went on this field trip, we went along a stream and we looked for salamanders. And we actually found six different species of salamanders. If you folks have ever gone out into the woodlands up here in the north, I remember as a kid hiking in the woods after a rain, when the salamanders would come out of their dens, maybe they were getting flooded out. And they were, I only ever saw one kind up here, but there are more, and they're called the red elfed. If you remember them, they have an aquatic stage and a terrestrial stage. And when they're terrestrial, they're red, and they have dots on them. And their aquatic stage is they turn green with the little brown spots. And they need the aquatic stage because that's where they lay their eggs in there. So they're like amphibians. And so we did that, and that was very interesting because I had never seen so many different salamander species alive, not in a little zoo or someplace. Okay, so one of the speakers at the conference was this fellow named Bob Keast, owner of the Tennessee River Freshwater Pearl Farm. Now, he brought one of his divers with him, and they demonstrated how they capture these critters and open them up, and we saw the pearls growing inside them. Now, Carol, what have you learned about where pearls come from? What kind of an animal?
Oysters.
Okay, everybody says that pearls come from oysters, but they really don't.
Okay,
the critter that they come from is like a mussel.
Okay,
you're familiar with mussels?
Of course,
you did mussling
them.
As a kid, right?
Yes.
On Long Island Sound.
Yes.
Okay, so our page that Jack has, I have a picture of this critter. It's a freshwater mussel. It looks like a clam, and it's not an oyster. So oysters really don't come from
pearls
don't really come from oysters. They come from a critter that's a mussel. And I'm going to read to you from one of my favorite books, The Big Oyster by Mark Harlansky. I remember, I think I did a show way back when, and I quoted from his book when I was talking about New York City oysters
that,
and all that.
Yeah.
So Mark says that the Dutch, when they came here and they saw these millions and billions of oysters, which they used for food a lot, they thought they were going to clean up because there would be pearls in these oysters. But it turns out that the oyster that grows in North America, and I'll give you the scientific name of it in a minute, doesn't have pearls in it.
But oysters elsewhere grow pearls.
Well, not really.
Really? I can't hold on to that, sir.
I know. Everybody's has that in their heads.
Right.
So I'll read you what Mark says from his book. He says that if an irritating foreign particle,
right,
something indigestible, is sucked in by an ostrid, which is the scientific name of the oyster family,
right,
ostrids, it's a true oyster, the animal ejects it. In a few cases, a coating is built up, but it is a dull gray substance, usually applied in an irregular sphere, and it's dull looking. It's brown and dull looking. So while it may look like a pearl, it has no value because it doesn't have that beautiful luster,
mm-hmm,
of pearls. So I'll read you a little description from Mark's book. Lustrous, bright, valuable pearls are found in an animal popularly known as a pearl oyster. We all grew up that way.
Right.
But known in biology as Melagrina or Pintada. While being a bivalve is an animal that has two shells like clams and scallops and oysters. While being a bivalve whose shell bears a physical resemblance to an oyster shell, the pearl oyster, which is most commonly found in tropical waters, belongs to the family Pteridae, not the family Ostridae, okay? You don't have to remember that, but, you know, this is a sort of a scientific program, so we have to do that. A number of animals in this family have the characteristic that if an indigestible food particle, not a grain of sand, as is commonly believed, gets trapped in the shell, the animal will build up a coating of calcium carbonate crystals called aragonite and a protein, conchoitin, yeah, I think that's how you say it, it's conchoitin, how would you say that? Well, we'll call it conchoitin. The tumor materials that it uses to build its shell. These two ingredients in surrounding the particle become nacre,
mm-hmm,
and that's the term,
right,
that we use.
Right.
N-A-C-R-E, yeah. Nacre, or mother of pearl.
Right.
So you know, you've all seen shells even on the beach that have this beautiful lustrous nacre,
right,
inside,
right,
and that's mother of pearl. And mother of pearl is in almost all shellfish.
Right.
Okay, abalones and conchs and even scallops and mussels and,
right,
clams and,
yeah,
oysters. They all have this beautiful coating of nacre inside their shells, which makes them valuable for some things. So the first point I want you to remember today is that pearls do not come from oysters.
Right.
They come from a form of mussel. And I'll just finish reading this from Mark, and then we'll talk some more about that. The pearl oyster and its relatives in the Pteridae family are more closely related to mussels than oysters. Pearl oysters attach to objects by extending threads, the way a mussel does.
Which is what mussels do.
Yes.
Right.
So Carol and I know we both have harvested mussels, that if you go in, they're down in the bottom, you pull them out, they're attached by these threads called Bissell threads.
Even when you eat them, there are some threads attached.
Yeah, sometimes
attached
the threads are attached,
yeah.
Okay? But not, but the oysters doesn't do it like that. It secretes a substance from its foot, and it makes a cement.
Oh.
It cements itself to the bottom, or to other oysters or other stuff. So you can all amaze your friends now, and you could say, do you know where pearls,
right,
come from? And everybody's going to say, where did they come from?
Right.
Oysters, right? But it's not really an oyster. It's a mussel. Now, the picture on the website, on our page, the tag page, has a picture of the shell, and it looks like a clam.
Mm.
It's oval. It doesn't look like the muscle that we harvested to eat,
right,
which is the blue muscle.
Right.
Okay, so just think about that. All these years we've been calling it an oyster.
The pearls come from oysters, yeah.
But it really comes from a critter that's more closely related to a mussel. And I'm going to stop for a minute and take a little break. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you how a pearl is developed, how it's made, the difference between natural pearls and cultured pearls. It's a very interesting story. So stay tuned. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air, and remember, we're talking about pearls and mussels and oysters and all that kind of stuff, because we had this lecture at the National Marine Educators Conference. A man came who runs this facility in Tennessee, and where he raises mussels, freshwater mussels, to grow pearls. So We said that pearls really come from this mussel, and because the oyster that's in North America doesn't have any pearls in it, they don't develop a pearl. And if it is, it's a dull-looking, as I said, brown-looking thing. Okay, so let's see. Okay, I spoke about the Dutch who thought they would get rich because. They thought that they could harvest all these oysters in New York Harbor and really get rich. But they got rich because they got a lot of food from them, from the billions of oysters in the Hudson River estuary and on Long Island and the whole area.
So you're saying the Dutch knew about pearls, and they must have had pearl-bearing oysters, pearl-bearing mussels in Europe?
Well,
Japan or what?
They had a similar species, but those species in Europe... No, they didn't have pearls in them.
So also thought, it wasn't just us, they also thought the pearls came from oysters.
Right. But they did have pearl fishing in South America.
Okay.
In their colonies in South America, they were getting very rich from the pearl fishery.
Oh, that's the answer.
So that's what we're going to talk about now, okay. Natural pearls and cultured pearls. All right, so just a quick note. If you've ever heard about pearl divers, probably everybody has heard about pearl divers. They used to be the only method of gathering pearls, mm-hmm, years ago. And these pearl divers would train themselves to dive. They wouldn't even dive down. What they would do is, they were mostly local folks, like natives of different islands in the Pacific and Japan.
You always see films of women pearl divers in
women
Japan.
Women pearl divers, yeah, in Japan, right. So what these women would do is they would train themselves to hold their breath,
right,
for a very long time. And they would jump off the side of a boat and probably just wear goggles on their face so they could see clearly underwater. And they would carry a stone with them. And the stone would be their weight and carry them down to the bottom. Just like today, if you go diving, you wear a weight belt. It's the same thing. But they would release the stone when they got to the bottom, and they would have a knife with them, and they would cut these, remember, they're mussels now, they're not oysters, even though I keep saying oysters. Right. They would cut them from the bottom where they were growing and see how many they could collect in a mesh bag and bring it back up to the boat and put it in the boat, then go down again. So in the Museum of Natural History, our favorite museum in the Hall of Ocean Life, we have this diorama showing the pearl divers. And it's one of the original dioramas from the museum. It was done a long time ago. And it's a beautiful thing, but it's now sort of a historical relic because there's no more of that going on for wild pearls. So that was the way to get pearls many years ago commercially. Also, in the United States, in most of the rivers that were in the Midwest, the Mississippi River, the Tennessee River, Ohio River, most of the rivers in the central part of the United States have these mussels that are growing there. And they're very, very, very numerous and very profuse. So they use them for two things. They would, like on Sundays, it was a big activity for young people. After church, they would go to the river and they would dive down and pick up a mussel and then cut it open and see if there was a pearl in it.
Okay.
And sometimes there were pearls in them, okay? But this mussel is inedible. The flesh is not as good as our North American mussel, which we use for food. But it was good for pearls. And also, a huge industry arose in the United States in the early 1800s for mother of pearl.
Right.
So mother of pearl comes from the shell of any one of these bivalves, or even not a bivalve, from conchs, which have one big beautiful shell,
right,
and abalone, and scallops, clams, and mussels. So this mussel that grows in the rivers of the Midwest became a big industry. And they started to harvest them, and there was a big industry in the middle of the United States, in Iowa and all the middle states, of making buttons, mother of pearl buttons.
Yeah, yeah.
So we all remember mother of pearl buttons,
sure,
right? They have this beautiful lustrous sheen,
right,
and almost all the buttons used. I remember men's shirts, the pearly looking buttons, right?
Yeah, I'm looking at your buttons.
Well, these are
probably plastic now, right?
Probably plastic now, because that's what happened to the industry.
Yeah.
And I researched this and I found illustrations of factories that were in some of these small towns. It was a home industry. Mm. First of all, they would collect the mussels. They would open them up, clean them, and then even when the industry first started, people at home would have a primitive drilling device that would cut out the blank for a button.
Right.
And then what they would do is they would send that to another family who would put the holes in the button and put a design on it, if there was a design, or just sew it onto a card. So they would make the buttons and then sew them onto a card, and then they would sell them to a wholesaler who would, you know, peddlers who went around with buttons and notions and all that kind of stuff.
Interesting.
So that was a nice industry in the United States, but two things happened. First of all, they overfished the mussels, so it was harder and harder to get them. And secondly, plastics came in.
Right.
And if you look at a button today, you couldn't tell whether it's a natural button from a mussel or that it's made out of plastic, because they really have the sheen of the beautiful mother of pearl.
That's true.
So that industry died out, but another industry started. There was this man, his name was, let me get his name just right, because he's an important guy in the history of mussel raising. His name was John Landress. And John Landress got this idea to try and grow cultured pearls in the Midwest, in these rivers. I don't know if this is by chance or he planned it this way, but he married a Japanese woman diver, and he brought her back to the United States, and she knew the process of doing it. So they went and they looked for the perfect stream, the perfect river, and it happened to be in Tennessee. And in this stream, it's a small river, I think, they found the perfect conditions for capturing the mussels from the river and bringing them up and then making a cultured pearl for the mussels. Some of those mussels had natural pearls in them, but you couldn't really depend on that supply for an industry. So they did what the something that the Chinese did many years before that. The Chinese were pioneers in culturing pearls, but they really didn't do it the way that the industry evolved. What they used to do would be to put anything that had a shape in the mussel and leave it there for a few years, and this nacre, which produces the mother of pearl, would grow over it because this object would be an irritant for the mussel, and then they would harvest it. So years ago, they used to do a little statue of Buddha.
Oh, right.
The Buddha would come out, they would make it out of lead, and then insert it into the mussel and wait a few years and harvest it, and then it would be covered with mother of pearl. So they became, and the Japanese did the same thing. But the man who's really responsible for the whole cultured pearl industry, besides Mr. Landress, was the Japanese guy, Mikimoto was his name. And if your mother or anybody in your family has a string of pearls, the chances are that they're cultured pearls from Mikimoto in Japan or from the United States.
I have a Mikimoto pearl bracelet.
Okay.
Beautiful pearl.
So, yes, and people love pearls. It's that lustrous iridescence in them. And they have a whole association throughout history of being a symbol of purity and things like that. I looked it up. There's mention in the Old Testament and all that stuff, and in some Chinese stuff. So, so the mussels in the Tennessee River have a quality unlike other species. The actual shell of the animal is a greater thickness than those found anywhere else in the world. So the thickness of the shell is much thicker than you would find in ordinary mussels or any mussel around the world. So this led to the following. Okay, other countries. That this is right up to date today. Other countries that are doing cultured pearls, which, and I'll tell you how that's done in a minute, acquire the thicker American mussel shells to create their nuclei, and I'm going to tell you what that is in a minute. All freshwater pearls, whether from China, Japan, Tahiti, Taiwan, or other countries in other parts of the world, most likely originated with a seed from the Tennessee River mussel shell. So what they do is they take the shells and they cut them up into small, tiny little squares, a couple of millimeters square, okay? And what do they do with it? They put it in a ball mill. A ball mill is a machine that will make irregular-shaped stones round. They sort of grind against each other, and there's BB shot in there, like BBs, and the BBs rub against them and make them into a spherical shape or the shape of a BB. So they would take the shell, cut it up into little pieces, and make it into this little, like, buckshot. There's a good comparison, because they're very small shape, and it would be made of the natural mussel shell. Okay, so what are they going to do with that now? Well, the process begins like this. They harvest the mussels. This is the Tennessee River that I'm talking about, the company of Tennessee, which is called the North American Fresh River Pearl Association or something like that. They have divers. The divers dive down into the rivers, which are very murky, and they come up with a mussel that they're going to use, and it's about 4 inches across or 5 inches across, the size of our surf clams.
Big, yeah.
Yeah, they're big. And they take it and put it into, these are fresh water now, so they don't have to worry about salt water from the ocean. They put them in a tank, and they let them rest for a couple of days until they get used to this new environment. And then what they'll do is, they open them up slightly. And how do they open them up slightly? They get them to relax this strong muscle that keeps them closed. It's called the adductor muscle, which keeps them closed very tightly. They get them to relax, open just enough so they can take a special little tool, which these things look like jeweler's tools. And what they'll do is they'll take and they'll make a cut inside the living animal of the muscle and insert this little bead of mother of pearl, okay? And then to make sure that it's going to grow, they take a little piece of flesh from the mantle, which is the part of the muscle that does all the growing, makes the muscle shell grow, because clam shells, they all grow a little bit bigger each year. And you can see that on some of the shells have lines on them, like growth lines. So here's what they're doing. They're making an insertion like a surgeon would do. And, so, and these people have to wear protective masks, and they have to be very clean and very careful. They don't want to get any foreign organisms into the muscle shell. So they put the pearl in, the future pearl, the little shot or BB size, and then on top of it they put a piece of the mantle, which is living tissue. Okay, and then they'll let the muscle close up again, and then they put them back into the river. And but when they put them back into the river so they can retrieve them again, they put them in cages, which are sort of screening, and it's like a sandwich. Screening and the muscles inside, and they suspend them in the river.
Oh.
And they let them stay in the river from anywhere from a year to 2 or 3 years. And what happens is, since this is an irritant to the muscle, it starts to coat this little bead with nacre.
Right.
Okay? Which, as I said, is calcium carbonate, and it's the mineral aragonite when it crystallizes. And you get these beautiful crystals, and that's what forms the beautiful luster in the pearls. So picture it now. They put it back in the river. It stays there for a year or two or three, and they keep a record on each one that they put in, how long it's in, and what shape irritant they put in. Most of the times it's round so they can make pearls that they can sell, but sometimes they'll put it in an oblong shape,
right,
or in some other shape, and they use that for jewelry also. And speaking of that, a lot of other societies have used mother of pearl as decorative elements in their jewelry, in their decorations.
I always think of freshwater pearls as at least some of the time being irregular in shape, where you think of cultured pearls as being perfectly round. What is the difference?
Well, the irregular shape ones could be a natural one that grew that way. If it's a geometric shape, like ovals or or other shapes, that was probably cultured.
Okay.
And sometimes they don't come out perfectly round. You know, they come out oblong or, you know, or something like that. So that's the process that they do it.
Very interesting.
And the man, the Japanese guy, Mikimoto, I'll tell you a little bit about him. He was the one that really got this industry going, because he was raising mussels for pearls, and he was having a lot of trouble. In fact, something that we spoke about once before, a red tide attacked his mussel beds and killed all of his mussels.
Mm.
So he decided that he had to be very careful from now on and get them isolated and not do it in the open seas. So he was raising them now in a captive environment.
Mm.
So he had to start all over again. But he became famous, and as Carol said, she owns a bracelet of Mikimoto pearls, which are world famous. But the Japanese are having a lot of trouble too, because a lot of the waters are getting polluted.
Mm.
And so who's taking over? Is the Chinese, you know, producing a major crop of pearls these days. Okay, so a little bit about the history of pearls. Now that you know how it's done, and you can amaze your friends with this story,
right,
of cultured pearls are ones that are inseminated with a little bead, and then the muscle produces this nacre and coats it, and you get this beautiful, lustrous appearance of pearls.
How big an industry is this in Tennessee? Did you buy pearls? Do they have a shop where you can...
Yes. Funny you should ask. This guy who came to talk, he has made it into a major attraction in Tennessee.
Yeah, I wondered.
Not only does he have the pearl farm, he has a resort on the river where you can go to visit this place. It's in central Tennessee, not too far from Nashville, and you can go and stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of your stay, it's like a motel, but it's right on the river. It looked like a really pretty spot, and then you get a complete tour of this operation, and you get a barbecue dinner and country music,
right,
and it's a whole experience. And I think if you're in Tennessee, you should probably go to see it, because it's very unique in North America. He's probably the only one that's doing it commercially,
right,
in North America,
right.
This farm. And
I once went to what they call a pearl diving party on Long Island, where somebody comes. It's like a Tupperware party.
Oh yeah.
Somebody comes with a big dish full of, I guess, mussels,
yeah,
and you pay a certain amount, and you open the mussel, and if it has a cultured pearl in it, you can use that pearl, and then they sell settings, and you can have it actually
terrific.
It's a whole event, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's the Descendant of Tupperware party.
That's right.
Yes, I remember when I was younger that everybody had Tupperware parties.
Right.
And for you people who don't know what we're talking about, Tupperware is a kind of a ceramic material that's very tough. And people, when they got married, they usually got presents of sets of Tupperware.
Right.
And Tupperware, they're very good for making casseroles and stuff in the oven. But they're no good as a frying pan. I remember that because they're not as good transmitters of heat as aluminum or steel.
Well, but Tupperware is also for storage.
Oh, I'm thinking.
You're thinking of something else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not Tupperware. What was that other ceramic?
Corningware.
Corningware, right. Sorry. Right. See, my history is getting mixed up. Yeah, Corningware is the cookware, but Tupperware are all these plastic containers in all shapes, sizes, and colors that you use for storage.
And they used to come to the house and do a party.
Right.
And the key event was they'd fill one with water and drop it on the floor to show you that they didn't open.
Right. Okay, that's
right. But anyway, we're getting far afield from pearls.
Far afield from pearls. Okay, so I have 2 minutes left, so I just want to tell you now, I told you about the little bit of history of cultured pearls. The Japanese did it, and the Chinese did it. Now, a little bit about care of your pearls. If you have pearls in your family, you have to really take care of them. They're not as durable as gemstones, of course, as diamonds, which is the hardest thing that there is, or even rubies or emeralds or other gemstones. So what you should do with your pearls is they're sensitive to acid, dryness, and humidity. If you wear cosmetics or perfume, put these on before putting on your pearl jewelry. When taking off your pearls, wipe them dry with a lint-free cloth. If needed, clean your pearls with warm soapy water, being very careful not to get water into the drill holes as the pearls may discolor. Mm. Dry your pearls flat on an absorbent towel, preferably lint-free, and always store your pearl necklaces or bracelets flat, as the silk will stretch. You know, they string pearls on silk, and in between each pearl there's a knot.
Right.
So you don't want that to stretch. Store pearls separately from other jewelry, as they will scratch. Store pearls in a dry environment. Avoid using plastic bags, as moisture may get trapped and cause damage. Okay, and then a little thing about Roman pearls. Those are really glass beads.
Ah.
So people know about Roman pearls. Okay? So just I'll finish off with the beauty and desirability of pearls dates back many, many years. There's an old tale that says Cleopatra placed a pearl in a glass of wine, and when it dissolved, she drank it to impress Mark Anthony. So how's that story?
All right, pretty impressive.
Yeah, because, you know, wine is acidic, and the pearls are calcium carbonate, and they will dissolve from an acid. So you have to be careful. Don't do that, Carol.
I'm just thinking about what her point was.
I don't know.
What was behind that?
Oh, there's another story about Mikimoto. He lived to be 98. And somebody asked him, what does he attribute his longevity to? He says every morning he used to eat two pearls.
Oh, there you go.
Which made him live a long time. So maybe it has something to do with that. I don't know. I couldn't figure out why she ate these pearls.
Well, yeah.
Maybe because she was so rich that she could just...
contribute to her beauty. I don't know what the challenge was.
Okay. And
we need to know more about this. We have to ask her.
We have to do research on her.
They can only speculate.
Okay, and some famous pearls. I have some notes here about Elizabeth Taylor's gift from, what was his name, Richard Burton?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Richard Burton gave her a beautiful, huge pearl that had been found by a slave off the coast of South America in the 1800s or 1700s. And when he bought it for her, this was, I don't know, probably in the 1980s around, when were they together? I can't keep score about
it. I can't either.
Okay. He paid $36,000 for this one pearl that he had mounted. He took it to Tiffany's, and they mounted it and made it into a beautiful piece of jewelry. And speaking of Tiffany's, Tiffany's didn't start carrying cultured pearls into the 90s.
Right.
Before that, they only had the wild pearls,
right,
natural pearls. And that's why pearls were so expensive years ago, because there wasn't this big industry to make cultured pearls. So you if you have the two side by side, you couldn't tell the difference with them. And actually, the cultured pearl is nacre all the way through, because the bead that it's made from is from the shell of the mussel.
Right.
So if you have any other questions about pearls and jewelry and all that, you can write in. We always like comments. And my partner Carol, since she owns some pearls, she can probably give you some advice on it. And if you have any old pearls lying around the house you want to get rid of, well, we'll take them off your hands.
Colorful pearls, too, as a whole other aspect.
That's true. I didn't mention pearls come in many colors. Yeah. Like when I was in Tahiti, we visited a pearl farm in the Marquesas Islands, and they had black pearls.
Right.
And that's because it came from a mussel that produces black pearls.
Right. Well, a lot of black pearls are dyed. You have to be careful.
Right. A lot of pearls are dyed these days. So if you buy pearls, you should go to a reliable dealer and not the guy off the street on Canal Street.
Right.
And buy your pearls. So with that words of advice, I'm going to sign off. And this is Bernie Wide, the Naturalist. And today's subject was partially the National Marine Educators Conference. And I'll have some more information on that in future talks. And next week's talk, Carol Butler is going to talk about other sexual strategies and other interesting stuff on critters. So we'll see you next week.